And you're tuned in to the Jewish Activist Network, broadcasting right here on AM 620 from 12:30 a.m. to 1 a.m.
Hello, and thank you for being with us once again on Jewish Activist Network. We have a packed show today. We will be having on with us Yekutiel Guzovsky. Yekutiel Guzovsky is going to be speaking with us, continuing from last week, talking about his dog program. We have, we're going to be talking about the J Street protest against J Street that happened in New York and the press that occurred. We also going to be having talking a little bit, if we have time, on Rabbi Eidenson. We're going to read a letter from Rabbi Eidenson, who's very concerned and upset, rightfully so, about a gay rights bill that has been passed. And let us begin, Joe.
Yeah.
Joe, are you with us?
Yeah, this is, I'm Joe. For our listeners who are tuning in, I'm Joe Orlo, your host on the Jewish Activist Network. And I want to tell you a little bit about a protest that we did. I've done many protests over the years. You know, you lose track after a while of how many, you know, dozens, if not up to 100. And this was probably one of the most successful. And the protest was against an organization called J Street. And I don't claim to be an expert on what they stand for, but based on their website and from many articles that have been written and speaking to a number of people, including the people I met at the J Street conference, I don't think it's unfair to say about them that basically they've taken the Arab position as far as what's going on in the land of Israel. They basically, that's their, that they, when they, when a lot of people talk about a two-state solution, but when they talk about it, they're looking at it from the Arab position. And many of the people who are members, including the person who founded it, and many of the people who attended the conference are Jews. And I found it a little bit disconcerting that they would have such an anti-Jewish position. And maybe on a later show, we'll go into all the details about just why it's an anti-Jewish position. But we went as far, and I don't think it was unjustified, we went as far as implying that they had taken a Nazi-like position. And what was shocking and amazing to me is that many of the people that we spoke to, when they understood that we were basically calling them Nazis, or implying that they were Nazis, they didn't argue with us. You know, they didn't like it. They were offended, as some of them told me. They were shocked. They took it badly. But at the same time, they didn't deny it, which to me implied the following, that they understood that what they were doing was Nazi-like in the sense that they were bringing about, God forbid, the destruction of the Jewish community in the land of Israel if their policies were to be seen through, if the money they were raising and using to influence Congress was used in the way they wanted it to, that it could lead to the deaths of many Jews. They didn't deny that. What they didn't like was us saying it outright and so starkly and calling them Nazis. In fact, the way I took it is they were saying we're so over the line that nobody would dare call us a Nazi. And we did call them. And it was covered in much of the media. And maybe we'll get back to this idea in a little while, at about 10 to 1. Right now, let's take our guest, our special guest this evening, which is Yekutiel Guzovsky. Welcome to the Jewish Activist Network, Yekutiel.
Shalom, shalom.
Shalom. Yekutiel, last week we spoke to you about your program. Tell our listeners again the name of your organization and its overall goals, and in particular, fill us in a little bit on what's been happening. Last week you told us that one of your dogs was being used at a farm, and we'd like an update to know if anything has happened. Have the dogs actually been, you know, have there been actual cases of intruders coming in where the dogs had to go into action, and so on and so forth?
Well, the name of the organization in English is Dogs for the Defense of Israel, and we have dogs in many forms throughout Israel, in Judea and Samaria, as well as in the Negev, and our dogs are active in preventing penetrations and infiltrations and terrorist attacks in these areas.
All right, and if people want to learn about it, I'm looking at my notes from last week. You told us that it was defendisrael.net for a website, and a phone number for people to reach you would be 011-972, which is the way to call Israel from the United States, and then the actual number, 3906-8478. So last week you had your dogs being assigned to a certain farm to defend a farmer. Do you have any report or update regarding that, how it's going.
There's still a lot of work to be done on that farm and getting the dogs fully ready for their task of defending the farm. And we hope to be bringing additional dogs and volunteers to that specific farm.
Okay. Now, in particular, I was wondering, you told us a little bit about how the dogs can defend the farm if there are attackers and so on. Have there been any cases where where the dogs have been on other farms where they've actually repelled any real attacks?
Oh yeah, we know of many cases where our dogs help detect Arab terrorists that were trying to sneak into towns or farms. And we know of cases where our dogs helped the IDF, the police, actually track down the terrorists before, during, and after attacks. Yeah, so our dogs have a proven track record, an effective track record. And there are many cases that we know of, sure.
Historically, just to give us a little background, around the world, are other people doing this also, or is this a novelty of what you're doing? How are dogs in general used to protect people, especially in, I don't know what to call it, the situation is almost in a warlike state in some of the areas where you have the dogs deployed?
Well, I'm sure you've heard the expression dogs being a man's best friend.
Uh-huh.
And that is, dogs are used in many applications to help people, whether it's handicapped people, whether it's people that need defense. Dogs are very loyal. Dogs can also be trained and are very disciplined. Dogs are gifted with special sniffing senses. God gifted them with these senses that they're able to smell and sniff things that we cannot smell or hear or see. So naturally, dogs can be a very effective tool in giving early detection that there's some danger out there to its master, to its location. And dogs are used by armies and police around the world. I mean, I'm sure you've been at airports and you've seen dogs sniffing. I'm sure you've seen dogs as guard dogs. And we didn't create this wheel. God created this special tool, and smart people make smart use of this effective tool in detecting and also helping to neutralize threats.
What comes to mind is that as much as there's advanced technology in warfare, and there's a lot of very cool stuff out there, and it's amazing how it operates. But in reality, in order to get technology to have even close to the abilities of, say, a man or an animal, takes an enormous amount of work, and it's only at best an approximation.
Well, that's correct. I mean, there are many, many towns in Judea and Samaria and throughout Israel that use special fences or electronic fences, and they have special rooms where they, with sophisticated computers. I'm talking about systems that cost tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. And where, in fact, they can see, let's say there's a terrorist penetrating Zone A, and they see it up on the computer, and then they bring the cameras down to that area, and they're able to zoom in and straight from their command room and see everything that's going on. But only one little problem. Let's just say a terrorist comes, penetrates, already gets through, and now he's already in the town. Or a terrorist touches the fence and then jumps back and hides behind hides in a well or behind a tree or behind a rock or whatever. And then the guards come with their sophisticated jeeps that also cost, tens of thousands of dollars, and with their sophisticated night vision and projectors to try and locate where the terrorist is currently hiding. And they find that all of this equipment is ineffective in locating a terrorist who could be hiding 20 feet away. And there was such a case in Kiryat Arba a few years back when Rabbi and Rebbetzin Horowitz were murdered in their home in Kiryat Arba. Kiryat Arba has all of this sophisticated technology, which in some cases effectively does protect the town. But in this case, it was it was ineffective, because what the terrorist did was he cut out a little piece of the fence, and then when they detected in their command room that that area was being penetrated, they sent the jeeps out with all the sophisticated technology. The terrorist had put the little piece of fence back, and he was hiding just a few feet away behind a bush. And when they came with their night vision and projectors, they couldn't detect him. They looked around for 30, 40 minutes. They saw nothing. They left. The terrorists walked right back into the town and walked freely into a building and murdered Rabbi Horowitz and his wife and went on a shooting spree in Kiryat Arba. So this is a classic example where the dog can be complementary in together with all of this technology and make it all work, where they can immediately locate the terrorist. And any half-trained patrol dog would have done the job together with the security personnel when they came onto the scene in the general area where that terrorist was hiding.
Well, you know, as you describe, and let me just remind our listeners that they're tuned into AM 620 here on WSNR. I'm Joe Orlow, and you're listening to the Jewish Activist Network. Our guest tonight is Yekutiel Guzovsky, speaking to us from Eretz Yisrael, and Yekutiel is training dogs and deploying them to help defend individuals and communities against terror attacks. Yekutiel, from what you're describing, it sounds to me, just going over some of the attacks over the past couple of years that have made the news, that have had a dog been deployed, say, at the yeshiva where the young men were killed, or in a number of other cases where, you know, wherever there was a lone gunman, say where the someone driving a tractor is driving it into cars and so on, and, you know, dogs on the scene there with the right handlers, I guess that's the word, the people who work closely with the dog, that a lot of carnage and destruction could have been averted.
Well, yes, but you know, I want to give an honest and more exact picture of what the dog can do and can't do. I mean, at the end of the day, a dog is a dog. Just, you know, just like a person, God forbid, can be a guard, can be killed, a dog can be killed, you know, by the perpetrator of an attack, by a terrorist. But one thing is for certain, a dog can also be used, in most cases, by a good handler. I mean, a good dog with a good handler, in most cases, can be used to help track down a terrorist in an area where there is suspicious movement. And a dog can be used as a deterrent that would have the terrorist thinking twice before he enters the area. And a dog can also be helped, could be used to help neutralize a terrorist in many situations. If it's a hostage situation, rather than the security personnel breaking through the door and being the first one to enter, mm-hmm. it could be a dog that would be sent into that house where the terrorists are holding hostages. The dog would much more effectively operate in the dark, because they have, you know, natural night vision. They can see things that we can't see at night. And again, their ability to sniff thousands of scents that we can't sniff. I mean, the dog can sniff the aggressive person in the room. The dog can much more effectively and swiftly and quickly detect where the danger is in that room and help neutralize it. So there are many cases where dogs can be used. And by using dogs, it would save the lives of the security personnel there, and certainly enhance their ability to capture the terrorist.
And two other characteristics I don't think we've touched on is that the dog, being somewhat smaller than a human, could go through, say, a basement window, for example, and enter a building. Or if there was someone a little higher up, say on a tractor, that a dog can bound up and very quickly go up on a higher level also. And because of its speed, maybe we've touched on this a little bit, because of its speed, can run down an attacker also, you know, and ensure if it's a short distance.
Or they can be running at, you know, closer to the ground. These all make it more difficult for the terrorists to subdue. They have much more of a chance of survival than a human being who's revealing himself and running out in an open field to look for the terrorist. I mean, he doesn't have much of a chance if the terrorist, if it's a trained terrorist who's hiding behind a rock, you know, the security personnel would be killed. I mean, there was a situation with Rabbi Miller, who was the chief of security in Itamar, who was murdered 3 years ago. The Arab terrorists were shooting at the front gate. They couldn't locate exactly where the terrorist was. A very, very brave Jewish, you know, security man, this Rabbi Miller, came out, And he knew the general direction of where the shots were coming from, and he went right out in the open to chase the terrorists. You know, well, the whole element of surprise was in the hands of the terrorists, who knew exactly where he was, but he didn't know where exactly the terrorist was, and he was murdered. That's a classic example where a trained patrol dog could have been with this Rabbi Miller when he lied down. He could have lied down, protected himself, and just released the dog in that general direction. The dog would have found him. At worst, the dog would have been killed. Although, as we mentioned, the dog would have had much more a chance of survival than, you know, a full-grown man who was literally searching in the dark. And here, even if the dog would have been killed, which would have been a tragedy, at least it wouldn't have been a person, and they would have detected immediately the source of fire. So these are the ways that dogs are used in battle by armies around the world. The Israeli army, in fact, has a dog unit known as OKITS. It's a very good unit. But they have a limited amount of dogs, and certainly they don't have dogs to allocate to farms and to settlements throughout Israel. And it's a very, very costly venture. It takes time to train the dogs. You have to find handlers that will either volunteer or find the funds to pay, you know, the security people that will handle them. So I'm not saying it's an easy task, but that versus the loss of life, we know which is the... We favor, you know, the expense and saving lives.
For those who want to help you out and contribute to your cause, you're doing this on your own, not as part of the Army, not as part of the government. How would somebody contribute to you, and would their donations be tax deductible?
Well, people can contribute directly to our organization. They can send checks straight to Israel to P.O. Box 6592, Jerusalem, Israel. All they need to put on a letter is Dogs for the Defense of Israel. And the funds can go directly here to help sponsor dogs. God knows we need dogs. There are many, many places that are contacting us, and we just have limited resources. We can't be everywhere. We're currently training 30 such patrol dogs. But it's each one of these dogs can cost as much as, you know, $5,000-$10,000 after the first year of training them and acclimating them to where they have to be and raising them. That, you know, that it can cost as much as $5,000-$10,000 per dog and handler to get them ready. So people can help sponsor by sending a contribution to Dogs for the Defense of Israel, PO Box 6592, Jerusalem, Israel.
Is there a zip that would be associated with that, or is that enough just to say Jerusalem?
It can be sent straight to the PO Box when it gets there. Mm-hmm. As far as the tax deduction, a contribution directly to the Israeli fund wouldn't be tax deductible, but perhaps people can speak to their synagogues or whatever to mm-hmm. make the contribution through any, you know, tax-deductible vehicle in the States. Many synagogues and schools in the past have helped sponsor dogs in that way, where people made a contribution to their, you know, yeshiva or synagogue, and that was later transferred, you know, for direct purchase mm-hmm. of a security dog in Israel.
So any organization who has as part of its charter, say, the protection of Jews living in the land of Israel, so a contribution could be made to such an organization, and if someone could speak to them and to see how it would be done, but the money could then be sent to you. And your organization is Dogs for the Defense of Israel, P.O. Box 6592, Jerusalem, Israel. And you mentioned you're training as many as 30 dogs. Is that correct, that you have 30 dogs right now that you're working with?
Right now we're working with 31 dogs, and it's quite a task.
It's a tremendous amount of work. And if somebody wanted to, let me finish with this, and then I'm going to ask you to stay on as we discuss our next topic. If somebody wanted to come and see firsthand on their trip to Eretz Yisrael, they wanted to see that your operation, how would they get, you know, how would they get in touch with you, and what would they see when they come to visit?
Well, they can email me to jewishlegion@aol.com, and we can, you know, discuss meeting up, or they can call me on my mobile phone, 054-876-709. That's 0544-876-709. And there have been people that have come from the States and that were very interested in seeing this firsthand. And we've given people a tour from the northern Shomron to the Negev, because we have, you know, dogs set up in around 20 different places. We're training now, as I mentioned, about 31 different dogs, so they can really get a nice tour of Israel also, see a lot of interesting and beautiful towns and farms, and they can also see how we're using these dogs to effectively save lives.
So again, the contact information for those who want to visit Yekutiel in Eretz Yisrael. He's speaking with us right now live from Eretz Yisrael about his dog program. The contact information, email is Jewish Legion. That's Jewish, LEGION, JewishLegion@AOL.com. And his phone number, when you get to Eretz Yisrael, would be 054-476-709. And you could also call us here off the air. Our on-the-air and off-the-air number is 718-569-0921. We just have a few minutes left on our program here, Yekutiel. We were talking before about J Street, which you may be familiar with. It's an organization which has tried to bill itself as pro-Israel, which is not a well-defined term, but many people feel they are other than pro-Israel because of their openly embracing some of the approaches that the Arabs have to the Jews living in the land of Israel. And in particular, we were outside their conference here. We were outside their conference here in Washington, D.C., which was at the Hyatt Hotel, and the J Street organization has a logo, which is an arrow pointing up to the right, which kind of reminded me a little bit of a swastika. So I extended their logo down and made a swastika, and I made a sign that basically said J Street with their logo extended a little bit to look like a swastika. Other people had more direct signs that basically equated them with Nazis, and it seemed like over the top. But the reality is, and we might go into it in a later show, it wasn't over the top because of the positions they're taking, the people associated with them, and basically they have, to some extent, associated themselves with people who equate the Jews living in Israel with those who are perpetrating, you know, a Holocaust, which is, so they've kind of used that symbolism. The thing that shocked me the most was that many people that I spoke to didn't really deny that they were Nazi-like. There was one person in particular. He claimed, and I believe him, because in talking to him, he claimed to be, he claimed to be one of the people who, an officer who volunteered to be in the IDF for this mission to expel the Jews from Gush Katif. And so I went through with him and explained to him why what he was doing was Nazi-like. And at first he kind of backed away. I said, you know, did you just talk to the people? Didn't you threaten them? Weren't you carrying a weapon? He said he didn't carry a weapon. Others did. He did talk to them like he was talking to me. But then I said, but if they didn't go along with you, wouldn't you have used violence? And he kind of went into a daze, like for the first time realizing just what it is that he did in uprooting Jews from their homes in Gush Katif under the threat of violence. And from what I've heard from David Bedin, who's a journalist, that many of the soldiers who were involved in the Gush Katif expulsion were actually committed suicide. A number of them did that, and that it cannot be reported. David Bedin cannot report that in Eretz Yisrael because or if he did, he'd be violating some government censorship that's been going out that people shouldn't know about that. Probably the most shocking conversation I had was with somebody who was a Holocaust survivor. So I knew people might be calling in and saying that's offensive, you know, to call another Jew, Nazi, and so on and so forth. You know, I have a grandparent that was a survivor, and so on and so forth. So I actually spoke to a survivor there. I'm going to play a short interview. Maybe then we can comment it if we have. Maybe you could comment it if we comment on it if we have enough time. Let me try to bring up the interview here. Okay, here we go. Play. There it is. We're here outside the Hyatt Hotel with a survivor of the Holocaust. Please tell us a little bit about what happens to you in Germany and why you're here for the conference and how you see our protest.
All right. My name is Stefan Edlis. I was born in Vienna in 1925. Had 2 years under Hitler, came directly to United States in 1941 because we had our support people here. I was a member of HaShomer HaTzair, which obviously was one of the left-wing and I still believe that there is such a thing as a secular Israel that can be both pro-peace and give the Palestinians a chance to have a decent life. And so J Street was formed a few years ago by a third-generation Israeli who I met in Chicago, very impressive young man. And I believe that he certainly appreciates Israel as a nation. But he knows, like Tom Friedman said, you cannot have a pregnant baby in your belly forever. And something needs to be done. Whether it's a two-state solution or one state, there's always an open question. I'm beginning to think that perhaps one state would be better, considering that the Israeli consider it Eretz Israel, all of Israel. And perhaps that's the answer. But then you have to give rights to the people that are there. Maybe not all the rights, but most of the rights.
Now, I'm standing out here, and I'm comparing the people going into J Street to Nazis, that you, and I'm wearing a keffiyeh in order to just show the irony of the whole situation. What is your take on what I'm doing here?
Well, you know, I've just attended the ACLU dinner last night in Chicago, and freedom of speech is essential, as long as it's non-threatening. And I know you have your right to say what you're saying. I have no objection to it. I just need to know that we have intelligent and dialogue that with a useful exchange instead of just yelling at each other.
Yekutiel, were you able to hear that?
Yeah. I think that you know that the man he spoke to was actually part of J Street. He was going inside, right?
Yes, that's right. He was going to the conference. I don't know if he was a member, but as you could hear, he himself was survivor of Kristallnacht and lived under the Nazis for about 2 years.
Right.
And at the same time, didn't have any objection to what I was saying. Seemed to say, well, that's free speech. But in talking to him further and many others, who, many people came out and talked to us and took pictures of us, and it made the media, people go online and put J space Street space Nazis in the Google engine, a search engine, they'll see a lot of hits, and a lot of the media covered it from BBC, Haaretz, and down the line.
Oh, yeah. In fact, that was the picture that I saw out here in Israel in the major newspapers here, was the picture of a demonstrator holding a swastika or words at Nazis.
Channel 1 on television in Eretz Yisrael did some coverage of us. Go ahead.
Right. I mean, I actually think that they're more like Judenrat than like Nazis. I mean, in the end, they're perhaps serving the same goal. These are Jews that are being used as tools by the Obama government and by the most extreme elements of the left and by the modern-day Arab Nazis. Definitely they're being used to further the goal of the destruction of Israel. But like a lot of people, like this guy that went in, he loves Israel, he feels an affinity to Israel. He doesn't even support the typical two-state solution necessarily, which is, the ABC for the people that are there that want to Israel to surrender its sovereignty over its borders. I would be careful in calling that guy a Nazi, but certainly they're helping, whether he realizes it or not. He may be a very decent, and he sounds like a very decent fellow. They're being used as tools in a Nazi-like chess game to destroy the state of Israel.
I actually spoke to him more at length after that interview because he came out again. We spoke for about 15, 20 minutes, and I don't think I went over the top, actually, in my description of him, because he was talking about how sometimes a bomb would fall, and the way he would say it so blithely, like two people were killed, meaning two Jews were killed. It didn't bother him. It just had no impact on him. The whole idea was just to move forward with this, and somehow, like he says, you use that analogy of you can't be pregnant forever. What does that mean? So you're moving forward to handing the keys to the enemy that they will go ahead with the destruction of, God forbid, Jewish communities? Didn't bother him. It just didn't seem to faze him.
He's 100% right about you can't be pregnant forever. Israel needs to deal with the problem. There is a real threat to Israel's very survival, and there are two roads to take. There's the Kahana road, which is having faith in God and doing whatever is necessary to survive and dealing with the situation by removing the hostile Arabs from Israel, by ignoring the Goldstones, and by declaring an all-out war on places like Gaza that would make the last war look like a children's game. These are the things that Israel really needs to do to survive. The Goldstones of the world and the J Streets of the world are coming to limit Israel, coming to restrain Israel even further, and coming to bring about the destruction of the state of Israel.
That's a very fitting way to end, and we'll continue on this topic next week, God willing. Tune in next week, 12:30.